Hi folks, and thanks for listening to this podcast, One World, One Struggle. Usually this is the part of the podcast where I'd ask you to join the Tortoise Shack, click that old Patreon link and help us keep the mics on and the conversations going, but I'm not doing that today. I'm going to draw your attention to the link that's at the top of the page, and it's for a GoFundMe for our friend Zachaniah, who is still in Gaza. Listeners to the podcast and indeed to the Echo Chamber would be familiar with Zach. He's friends of both myself and Yusuf, and his family are back in Dublin and they want him home. We have exhausted all avenues. We've tried everything through diplomacy and through normal channels, and we just cannot seem to get anything done. So unfortunately now we have to go to an Egyptian evacuation company to try and get him home. So while you're listening to this podcast, please click the link, have a read, and donate whatever you can. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks for the support, sharing, liking. Enjoy the show.
Hello everyone and welcome to Palcast. This is Yusuf Jamal speaking to you from Istanbul. It's March 26th, Tuesday, 6 p.m. here. I'm very glad to be joined by my co-hosts Helena Coben of Just World Educational and Tony Groves of Tortoise Shack from Dublin. Today we have a very special guest from Portland, Oregon. I know that there are two Portlands in the U.S. Alexandria Salim. Alexandria Salim is a first-generation Palestinian-American, born in the diaspora and raised on the traditional tribal lands of the Chinook people, also known as Portland, Oregon. She is the third generation to be displaced from her family's village since the Nakba in 1948, and the first to be born outside of Palestine. Alexandria has been the Director of Arts and Community Engagement with the Center for Study and Preservation of Palestine in Portland since 2020. She's currently organizing with the Oregon to Palestine Coalition that has emerged to meet the growing need for diaspora organizing in Oregon since October 2023. Very good to have you, Alexandria.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Thank you very much. A quick introduction on what's happening in Gaza. 82 Palestinians were killed. Nine of them actually lost their lives as they tried to capture aid airdropped on Palestinians that fell in the Mediterranean. This is another tragedy. Five are still missing. A lot of things are happening. Helena is going to talk more about the U.S. resolution, the U.N. security resolution on Gaza, the ceasefire resolution during Ramadan, where the United States for the first time abstained from using the veto, the developments on the ground, the starvation that's still going on, the killing of Palestinians and bombing of entire families. Although there is a ceasefire resolution, there are a lot to talk about, but let's start by talking about organizing in Portland and Oregon. How did the landscape change since October 7, Alexandria?
The landscape has changed drastically, as I'm sure it has globally, which has been deeply encouraging to see. Often in Portland, it had been the same people organizing for years and years and generations, honestly. I remember seeing the same people who I'm now organizing with when I was younger going out to protest with my father. But there's now a new insurgence of organizers, young folks, and also solidarity, community, and joint struggle is becoming a stronger framework here in Portland that really didn't exist up until this moment. A lot of groups have emerged, too many to count, which is really interesting to watch how different communities are choosing to engage with building around this ongoing struggle. During this time, as we work towards ceasefire resolutions locally, ceasefire resolutions nationally.
So, Alexandria, it all sounds really exciting. Could you explain? I'm in Washington, D.C., on the traditional lands of the Piscataway, and, you know, this is a particular place, and we don't actually have representation in Congress, but Congress is all around us. So what are the main things that you and your allies do there? Is it mainly street actions, protest actions, boycott actions, lobbying with representatives? Like, tell us, give us a flavor of what's happening.
Yeah, so there has been a lot of consistent in the street movement. It doesn't mean that it's on the large scale that we would see in the Bay or like the organized scale, but we're seeing this desire for continuation to be out in the streets, especially with the national calls that are being called by PYM. And there's really a wide mix happening right now. We have, you know, the DSA chapter here is working towards boycotts and bringing in other folks. The coalition that I work with has, we have like 10 different organizations, some national and some local, that are working together. We just successfully lobbied for a ceasefire resolution at our county level. And that was passed a week and a half ago, I believe. So there's
a lot of
different things.
That's fantastic. So yes. that's at the county, which is larger than the city of Portland, is it?
Yeah, it is. And the city is too Zionist to even work on. But the county, we were able to actually work with a commissioner who...
So who are your allies? Could you please tell us more about the people that you work with?
Yeah, in the coalition that I'm working with primarily now, we have ILPS. We have...
Hang on. Could you spell some of these out a little bit? Because we have a worldwide audience.
Absolutely. ILPS is the International League of People's Struggles. And they work on projects across the nation of people's struggles with the Philippines and all over the world. And then working with three different Filipino solidarity groups that we have here in Oregon. And that's been really amazing to learn from them and like watch a really strong organizing community come and work with us on some of these initiatives and thinking about what it means to organize in solidarity long term. I've also been building relationship with Indigenous communities here, and there's been a lot of efforts towards solidarity and I think working towards understanding what a true joint framework, like joint struggle framework, could look like outside of just, we see you, we're showing up, we are at each other's things speaking. What does it look like to engage in working together on these imperial powers at the city and county level? I think we're really developing that framework right now here in Portland.
So what kind of activities have you been able to do in terms of boycott or divestment? Do you have chapters at the local universities and colleges? And are you able to, you know, really lead boycott things against McDonald's and other, you know, organizations that are involved in supporting the genocide?
Yeah, the what I have seen here in Portland is definitely a grassroots push towards the boycott in terms of a highlight of protests, right? Maybe focusing on a particular business in town. We have here in Portland, Boeing is our biggest target. And at the university level, the student union for Palestine that's at Portland State University has been working on a Boeing boycott because the Portland State University invests in Boeing and vice versa, sending students there to work. They have a partnership there. So I know like things like that, that's one of the places that students are putting pressure is where, what companies are we directly feeding into and how do we ask students to not be a part of that as well.
That's really exciting because, I mean, it sounds like that's almost getting to divestment or separation of the ending the agreement between Portland State and Boeing, given that Boeing is a major producer of the weapons that are being used in Gaza. So I'm sure they like the educational component of this is huge. And it's really exciting to be able to hit the weapons manufacturers, hopefully where it hurts. So kudos absolutely. To you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a long road, I think, but we have a big opportunity with we have Intel here in Boeing, and I think over years of pressure, I'm hoping that we'll be able to build. A large enough movement against that.
In Europe, I believe in the United Kingdom in particular, there has been a very successful campaign against Elbit Systems, which provides the Israeli military with infrastructure, weapons that are also used in Gaza today. I want to go back a little bit, and I want you to share more about your family and how you. Were displaced, and how do you see the role of your role now, but also the larger role of the Palestinians in the diaspora, second generation, third generation Palestinians, and what's happening and stopping what's happening in Gaza today?
Absolutely. My role and place as the third generation displaced from my family's village of Beersheba, has become more and more clear since October. In being born in diaspora, I also didn't have access to the language. My father was not able to teach me. So I felt this really large gap in being able to feel like I could be a voice and feel that I could connect on this level where I could be an advocate. If I couldn't connect with my family on that level, how could I advocate? And over the last few months, that has completely dissipated. And I've actually seen the depth of the role that people in my position play in being able to advocate as a US citizen, where I'm not dealing with the possibility of being persecuted in the same way. I have a huge responsibility and role to be able to speak and advocate on my family's behalf. My father and grandfather, my grandfather was displaced in the Nakba from Beersheba to Gaza in Jabalia. And my father was born in the Jabalia refugee camp. And then displaced again in 67 with his immediate family, father, mother, and siblings. One of his uncles remained in Gaza, and so I have many, many cousins still living in Gaza. We've lost many family members since the beginning of October in Jabalia, as you can imagine, where it's been massacres on massacres. Many of my family is now in Rafah in the south, and I've been in contact with them more than I had before October. I had felt like the language gap, it just made it so, what am I doing? Why would they want to talk to me when I can't speak the language? And now we're seeing what's possible with me being in the US. I've been doing large grassroots fundraising to support family. You know, there's a lot of different ways that we can engage in terms of having direct family in Gaza right now and supporting. But I think on the larger level of what it means to be in diaspora is to move us collectively past this humanitarian framework that kind of limits the resistance of the Palestinian people towards liberation, and being able to advocate for this long-standing resistance and end to occupation, and really holding that line politically and educating people on not just this current moment, but what does it mean to look at four generations, three generations?
How do you see the importance of, you know, this conversation between Palestinians in Gaza who are facing genocide today and Palestinians in the U.S. and the diaspora? I think we do not talk enough. I mean, Gaza brought us closer, which is good, but we need to continue this conversation.
Yeah,
and talk absolutely. To each other.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's been it's been really difficult to reckon with how much time and separation has gone by until this moment, and looking at what does it look like to now recognize the power and the strength in this global diaspora community. I'm of course witnessing it in the US, and in Portland, I'm definitely in a more isolated organizing space, but looking at what's possible globally right now, as we look at the role of social media, and how that has changed the ripple effects of how people are really seeing a consciousness shift in the collective mind around the Palestinian struggle. I agree that the more that we connect the dots, we work against the weapons of colonization and the spread of diaspora and the intentional disconnection that has happened for all of us in some way.
You know, Alexandria, I wrote a book about the PLO back in 1984, and it was clear then, because I was able to interview Abu Ammar Yasser Arafat and Abu Yad and Abu Jihad and all the big Abu Wahed, the founders of Fatah and the PLO. And Gaza had played a crucial role for them in their very early organizing. Gaza was always the crucible, and it remains the crucible. So then, you know, they did most of their organizing later in diaspora, specifically in the frontline countries, but also in Kuwait and the Gulf. And so there's always been this kind of relationship, a synergy between Gaza in particular and the diaspora. And Gaza has always sent a lot of, you know, its fine young people into diaspora, like Dr. Yusuf al-Jamal, like so many others. So, you know, I think it's completely right and wonderful that this organic connection between Gaza and the diaspora has been strengthened. But I know it's so difficult for people in diaspora to, you know, you have some survivor's guilt. You have, like, as you mentioned, some, like, problems with not speaking the language or whatever. But it's just really great. I want to thank Yusuf for leading this podcast and bringing all these great voices together. As we say, you know, one world, one struggle. And it really does seem to be that way.
Absolutely.
You know, I remember I was in Portland in early October 2023. And the next day I was on a speaking tour highlighting Light in Gaza, which our friend Rifat al-Arair also contributed to when he was killed by an Israeli strike on December 6th in Gaza. And I was joking with some young students. I said, like, I was trying to highlight the issue of travel restrictions and their impact on Palestinians. And I told them, you know, if you move from Seattle, we were in Seattle, and if you move from Seattle to, God forbid, Portland, and then you just change your address and it's something normal for you as a U.S. citizen, but in Gaza and the West Bank, this is not the case for Palestinians. And then some people came to me and they said, oh, by the way, we are from Portland. I said, oh, I meant Portland on the East Coast, not the West Coast. So I was able to get away with that. But again, you know, just telling people, like speaking, how do you speak to people so that they understand what we go through? Because there are people who understand, but there are people who do not. It's not even Gaza. Being from Gaza is a different level. Having family in Gaza is a different level than being from Jerusalem and the West Bank or 48 because of the fragmentation and colonization that you talked about. So how do you appeal to people or speak to them in a language, not necessarily a language, but what kind of stories or arguments that you use so that you get people on your side while organizing?
You know, it's been really interesting in this current moment, and I've had a lot of asks to speak, and not because I am an expert on anything. I didn't have the opportunity to have a lot of like rich organizing experience as a young person. There was nothing in Portland, but I'm seeing this desire from people to hear these personal family stories, and to be able to contextualize this really horrific and large moment. What does it look like on the ground? It's hard for me to imagine. Of course, I will never be able to fully imagine. None of us will, I think. But just people wanting to understand, like, how did this, either in this current moment, how did your family move from this place to this place? What are the conditions that they're living in? What does daily life look like outside of this larger catastrophe that we're seeing? I'm noticing that for people, these personal family stories and connections feel really important in looking at this really large, unimaginable moment. It's hard to even think about how to speak about it, but that's been for me the largest thing, even in lobbying, which this was working on this campaign was my first time lobbying, and I was often asked
There are a lot of people who get surprised, sometimes shocked, when they hear about our stories. But I'm sure also as a Palestinian who grew up in the diaspora, especially this time around, with what's happening in Gaza, because as I said, this is unprecedented. Could you please share with us a story that also touched you as a Palestinian advocating on behalf of your people in Gaza and the diaspora from your own experience and your family and surroundings?
The moment when you asked that question that sticks out for me was, I think actually at the very first month, watching my father, who would have been 5 years old in 67, which are his last and really only memories in Gaza because of the level of trauma. But for me, it was watching him see what was happening, being able to witness the just like deafening trauma that I had never really seen him show, right? He often didn't talk a lot about what had happened, for obvious reasons. But in this moment, I saw something different I had never seen from my father. And he was like, you see those kids? That was me and my cousins. And now I'm witnessing my cousins who I was hiding under the beds with for weeks. Now I just found out that that cousin who had survived all of those massacres in Jabalia since I left when I was 5 was martyred. You know, it was just this, like, thinking about this long trajectory of survival amidst the unimaginable, and what that looks like to see a child who experienced something similar, and what it for them to be telling their own children. It was this really profound full circle moment, but not the full circle that feels good when we talk about that.
On intergenerational trauma, you've expressed it beautifully.
Yeah.
Thank you for doing that.
Yeah, I think, you know, it often does take some decades before, you know, especially people who were children at the time of the traumatic episodes are able to, like, even verbalize. You know, they, first of all, you have to survive. So you have to, like, tamp it down and not talk about it because you have to, like, figure out a way to survive. So it can take definitely decades. And I think, you know, it's coming out again and again and again for Palestinians, but also for all the other formerly colonized people around the world. You know, the Filipinos that you talked about, Kenyans. You know, when I was growing up in England in the 1950s, there was, like, the Mau Mau in Kenya were so threatening, we have to suppress them. You know, it was like all this demonization of the Kenyan nationalists who were known as Mau Mau, who actually included President Obama's grandfather, who was locked up in a concentration camp. And they had, you know, all these horrendous means of trying to maintain colonial control in Malaysia, in, you know, the French in Algeria, all around the global south, the global majority of countries. When they see what Israel is doing to Palestinians in Gaza, it strikes a chord. You know, they recognize this colonial outpouring of just vengeful, unhinged violence against the indigenous people. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That's been another really profound experience has been, this is a moment where, you know, walking around living daily life feels absolutely untenable. And the people who I know see what's happening are often the indigenous people who I'm surrounded by. And I've had many friends who, their family's indigenous to Turtle Island, to the Americas, say, I never thought that I would see what happened to my people. My own daughter was learning about the Trail of Tears in a book, and she said, that's the Nakba. My daughter's 5. You know, that being able to understand the connections globally and what we're seeing. Yeah. Absolutely.
Trail of Tears was shamefully led by an Irish immigrant to America, and we have our own colonial past in that. So yeah, just that's pretty bad to be bringing that memory up. But thank you.
Yeah,
you know, Alexandria, this reminds me of Nakba survivors who had to experience Nakba in Gaza in 2023. And one of them is Ahmed Al-Hajj. We mentioned him on this podcast. Helena met him in Gaza. He was 90 years old, and he passed away under siege on January 17, 2024, in the north of Gaza. And I remember how he told me the story of being under siege in the village of Fallujah in 1948. So it's a continuation of Nakba. This is the ongoing Nakba that we've been speaking about for many years. 75 years down the road, he relived Nakba, and his heart couldn't take it. He passed away.
My uncle had a very similar story of watching, you know, being displaced and living in Jabalia and witnessing 3 of his children and all of their children martyred. And my understanding is that he passed on the journey, not in the rubble. And having to witness an entire life, you know, he was probably close to 90, and witnessing that cycle is just unimaginable.
So shall we get on and talk about the ceasefire? I know it's not coming into effect anytime soon. I don't know. I'd love to hear from you, Alexandria, what kind of response you and your organizing colleagues have had to the news of the ceasefire.
There's definite, it's funny to find words, excitement is not the word, but there's energy around seeing this shift in just what we've seen for this entire time, what we've seen for years and years and years. All of a sudden it looks like something might be moving, right? The dial might be switching a little bit. We don't know what that means in terms of on the ground. We hope that it means we're going to see a shift. But even just seeing globally that in a short amount of time, not a short amount of time in terms of how much horror has been witnessed by Gaza, but short amount of time in terms of the timeline, that something could go so far in the other direction. We didn't know that that was going to be possible.
Yeah, the ceasefire resolution was obviously bearing in mind that the Biden administration has vetoed three or four previous ceasefire resolutions. And I think they probably found that at the end of the day, very embarrassing in front of the global majority.
So this time
they didn't veto it. But then the State Department spokesman all of them in the State Department and elsewhere say that Security Council resolutions are not binding, which is amazing. It's not true. Security Council resolutions are binding on all parties. So that is a big problem for them to still be denying that. One of the problems that I saw with the ceasefire resolution is that there is no implementation mechanism, like normally a ceasefire resolution would say, and therefore, you know, we will have a UN mechanism to monitor the ceasefire, to monitor the disengagement of forces, to monitor things like, you know, exchange of hostages, captives, and whatever. And there is none of that. Instead of which, the resolution did talk about the negotiations that the US and Qatar and Egypt are leading, as though they may be prepared to let the US continue taking the lead on that negotiating process, which I think would be a real mistake. But we want, obviously, to see an end to this. And from my perspective, as somebody who has worked on U.S. foreign policy issues for 50 years now, God almighty, I want to see the U.S. become a responsible member of the international community and not try to boss everybody around as it has for the last 30 years. So there's still a lot of work for all of us to do, not to get a meaningful ceasefire, which means that the fire ceases, you know, which means that the assaults cease, which means that the genocide ceases. And just recalling that the International Court of Justice, which is the UN's major judicial body, on January 26th ordered the genocide to stop. So I don't know. Yusuf, what do you think? We're going to be able to do this anytime, like within the next 6 months?
I think the tide is shifting. What happened in the U.S. was a message from the U.S. to Netanyahu and his gangs, continuing, you know, with their genocide in Gaza. I don't think this is a major U.S. Shift in their foreign policy, but it's an indication of where we're going to. We've also seen, countries such as Ireland, Spain, Belgium, and Slovenia announcing their intention to recognize Palestine. So if we look at the situation in Gaza, it's catastrophic. This is Nakba. There is no other way to describe it. But on the long term, Palestinians are winning. We're winning the streets. We're winning campuses. We're mobilizing our diaspora. And we having, you know, a serious conversation with our people as a nation on self-determination and liberation. We always needed this conversation, and seeing more countries supporting Palestinians' right to self-determination is promising. As our Irish brothers and sisters say, our day will come. Yes, Tony?
Just on that, Yusuf, though, I don't know, you saw our Taoiseach, the Prime Minister, spoke to in the White House, and of course I'd wish he'd been harsher, but it went around the globe as if the first public rebuke of the US's policies in Gaza, which was really, you know, he subsequently has resigned. I can assure listeners it's nothing to do with what he said in the White House. He's just leaving office now, but at the same time, it was good to see an Irish Taoiseach stand up and say, we understand, because we understand that struggle, going back to that one world, one struggle idea. And then on the flip side, I do want to say that, spoke to people in Gaza this morning, and they said, it feels like Israel is the favourite child of the US, and it's just gotten its first ever little slap on the wrist. Just its first ever little slap on the wrist. A gentle tap, but it's a start.
Yeah, and so the U.S. understands that Israel is being isolated. The vast majority of people and governments in the world are against the genocide in Gaza, and they cannot continue. Even Trump, he said they have to finish, you know. But Israeli leaders do not seem to understand that, and they're blinded. There we have different examples in history of people being blinded for different reasons, but at the end of the day, we are winning. This is how I see it.
Yeah, one little part of this that I want to look at more over the weeks ahead is the whole matter of the demonization of Hamas in public discourse in this country. You know, first of all, after October 7th, there were all these, like, you couldn't stand up in public without somebody demanding that you've got to condemn Hamas. You've got to condemn Hamas. Now, that seems to have eased off a little bit, but still there is this continuing demonization of Hamas, which is an organization that participated non-violently and in very good order in an election in the occupied Palestinian territories in 2006 and then won the election. You know, so the Carter Center, everybody came out and said, yeah, it was a free and fair election and Hamas won. And ever since then, Israel and the United States have been really like mad at Hamas and desperate to reassert their colonial control over the organization. But meantime, you know, in February, the leaders of Hamas and Fatah went to Moscow and held a really serious discussion in Moscow over national unity. Just earlier this month in Qatar, where many of the Hamas leaders live, the Chinese diplomatic envoy held a meeting with Ismail Haniyeh. So, you know, the idea that the Israelis and Americans are pursuing that you can destroy Hamas through this genocide in Gaza is complete nonsense. Actually, Hamas is, at a world diplomatic level, much more powerful now than it was on October 6th. And, you know, if you're following what's been happening in Jordan, there are massive, massive protests calling, you know, for an end to the ceasefire an end to the genocide in Gaza. And many of those protests are organized by Hamas sympathizers, others by other parts of the resistance, like the Jabhat al-Shaabiyya or even Fatah. But, you know, I think this idea that you can destroy Hamas through the genocide, we need to attack that and say, no, it's not happening. Hamas is a part of the resistance movement and needs to be continued to be considered part of that. I don't know, how easy do you find it, Alexandria, to talk about Hamas in Portland, Oregon?
Mm-hmm. I think that since, like you said, like over the last few months, we've seen a little bit of a shift. And I think that's the like pushing the political line. That's like a big part of the work, is like pushing towards like resistance is key under occupation, right? Whatever that looks like, and like being able to have that as the bottom line. When we were doing this resolution with Multnomah County, we were met with Zionist lobbying groups being like, you have to condemn Hamas in the ceasefire resolution. That was our red line, was we will push back very hard on this. And we were actually able to succeed in pulling out all of the Zionist talking points. And that was people power. That was a lot of advocating. But I think that we are seeing what we have recognized here is asking that to be out of the conversation is has been the way to go. But I agree that the need for this pushback and recognition of Hamas as a important part of the resistance against occupation and its validity is a long-term important.
Yeah, just one point, Yusuf. Two very quick points. Just one for listeners' benefits. All of those actions you're hearing about how you can take it, we're seeing in Dublin, we're seeing across Ireland, people going into supermarkets, removing Israeli products from shelves, literally removing them, throwing them in the baskets, and we're seeing, people checking to where everything where it's purchased. What we're not seeing is the trade union movement getting as active as I'd like to see, but some of that is because they don't have the rights. So sometimes it's a shop steward might not have the right to say that they don't want to handle Israeli goods. So check with your local area. What's your entitlements as an employee? What can you do? What can you not do? We're not looking for people to lose their jobs, but we're looking to make a stand insofar as the actual labor laws allow. And then I'm sorry, but I want to make one really gruesome point, and it's kind of thing that's been annoying me. I don't know if you saw this, but a headline in Haaretz was, not just here to fuck Hamas, how the military campaign has taken over the dating scene in Israel. How disgusting is it that they're using this genocidal campaign to just purely use it as a way to hook up? I just find it absolutely, the mindset of it is barbaric, with soldiers posting pictures of themselves on dating apps now saying, I'm out killing people during the day and let's hook up at night. I just think, more has to be made of what's actually really happening. They're showing you, they're not just showing you on their TikToks now, they're showing you on their dating apps. It's horrendous.
I have never had to use a dating app, but then I've been married for nearly 40 years. So I'll take your word for it, Tony.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tony. And thank you very much, Alexandria Salim. And we're really truly sorry for your loss in Gaza. We're one people and it's one pain and one struggle. As we say, one word, one struggle. And you play an important role as a Palestinian in the diaspora and bringing about change and winning people's minds and hearts. Thank you very much for joining us. I would like also to thank my co-host, Helena Coben of Just Word Educational, and Tony Groves of Tortoise Check. I would like also to reiterate our position of calling for an immediate ceasefire.
Immediate and effective.
Immediate, yes. Effective, and permanent.
Yes, absolutely. In Gaza now, without any further delay, I would like to thank our co-sponsors, the Hashim Sani Center for Palestinian Studies at the University of Malaya. Thank you very much, and see you next week.
Thank you.
If I must die, you must live to tell my story. Sell my things to buy a piece of cloth and some strings, make it white with a long is a kind.